It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll get an update from Wisconsin Public Radio news reporter Mike Simonson on mining in northern Wisconsin.
And we'll also talk to a highway emergency patrol worker for our Hidden Wisconsin segment.
But first, we're talking to a journalist about her new book on people who have lost their homes through natural disasters, foreclosure, or a number of other reasons.
We'll want to hear from you during this discussion. What does home mean to you? Have you ever lost your home? What happened? Share your stories at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org.
Sally Ohms joins us now. She's a journalist. Her new book is Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. Sally, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob and Cynthia. It's great to be with you.
Sally, when I heard about your book, I thought, oh, it's homelessness. It's about people who've lost their housing. It's more than that. You're talking about home.
It is more than that. Yeah, it is more than that. About 4 years ago, I decided I wanted to interview people around the country who had been displaced for various reasons, and then talk to them about what steps they took to recreate their homes and further what home means to them. So I sort of started out with what I now call ex-victims of natural disasters, because they've moved through it and found great solutions. But anyway, the book just sort of moved into wider interpretation of home, so that I ended up with about 10 groupings of people. And so I interviewed former foster kids, whom I think we know so often get tossed from home to home and sometimes even separated from their siblings. And I talked with combat veterans from various wars who are returning home and feeling ill at ease with that environment they used to call home. I talked with older people who are making that decision to move into a retirement home, or very often deciding or resisting that move, I guess. And I talked with immigrants who are now citizens about their cultural shifts, and Navajo women who are fighting to improve the quality of their homeland. Then I talked to a formerly battered woman, another woman whose home had been foreclosed on more than once, and a man in Santa Fe who says that if you follow his program, you don't have to be in that predicament anymore. And then I did speak with homeless men, women, and one child as well. Yeah.
We'll dig into some of those stories, but after talking to all these people and thinking about the concept of home for so long, what does home mean to you?
Putting me on the spot, eh?
Yeah.
I've lived a number of places, but I've felt at home in most of them. I think that for me, it has a lot to do with the person I live with, and also how comfortable I'm feeling with my life in general. And then I love living near a community of friends. That's very important for me. I heard a quote the other day. It said, "The bird a nest, the spider a web, man friendship." So I think that that can mean home. I mean, and that brings me to, there were just really lots of definitions I ran into. I mean, it's really just that building we live in, is it? I mean, although that figures in greatly for a number of people, that sense of place, but, I mean, we don't want to go telling people in Moore, Oklahoma, whose houses have been ripped away by tornadoes, or Colorado Springs, who've lost their houses to fire, that isn't the strict definition of home. But what I discovered is there's just a wealth of meanings and combinations of factors besides your obvious ones, your partner, your spouse, your family, your close relationships, your friends. But, I mean, it can mean a community and a region, a religion, spiritual practice, as in the case of the Tibetan American woman I interviewed in San Francisco. And sometimes I think it just, it means that people carry home around in their heads and sometimes in their hearts. Sometimes it's simply feeling comfortable within your own skin, but no matter what, it seems to me the common thread is that it's a place bound up with our identity, and where we have that opportunity to be our authentic selves.
Well, let's explore that now through some of the stories that you tell, or your contacts tell in the book. And you said you started off looking at the impact of disaster. So let's start there. You talked to some people who had survived Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. What did you hear about them about home?
Well, the woman who comes to mind is a woman in East Biloxi. Now, mind you, a lot of attention was on New Orleans, which I think rightfully so. It was sort of a monstrous situation there. But in East Biloxi, this woman had never experienced a hurricane to begin with, and then much less the fury of Katrina. And then she just couldn't believe that nothing really was in place to help people in this Mississippi Gulf town, right? And they were just in extreme crisis. They were overlooked for just days and months, and not the simplest things like water or food and no shelter. So even though her husband is the representative of their ward on the Biloxi City Council, there's still things did not get done there. And so while she was stunned, and she's still stunned that no one came to help them initially, she's just remarkably unbitter. And they receive amazing help from nonprofits and churches and just individuals around the country and private sources. And so they ended up setting up their own nonprofit that has become this sort of shining example. I mean, Oprah has donated to it. But I'm sure for her it was so hard to recall those days where there was just nowhere to bury dead people. Children had nothing to eat. They were being eaten alive by flies. But it just all sort of screamed third world treatment. But they moved right on through that and found, I think, that one of the things I learned along the way, and I think Krija helped me with this, was that there is just a seemingly greater connection between and among people these days, and that there's great power in that connection. And then furthermore, I don't know, it comes to the fore when there are these times of crisis, you know, really hard times.
Is there a sense from some people, you talked to survivors of Katrina, also a major tornado elsewhere in the country, is there a sense of uncertainty about home when, you know, the place you live, in a sense, turns on you, the nature there attacks your house, the place you live?
Yes, yes, and I say, you, when that first happens, then you've lost your home. That's it. And there's really a grieving process. I mean, besides the struggle, the physical struggle to just survive, there's that the mayor of Greensburg, Kansas, who I interviewed and who initially called himself the mayor of nowhere because the tornado came through and took away the whole town. But anyway, I've lost the train of what we were talking about.
Well, his reaction to the tornado devastating his town.
And people's reactions, yeah. Yeah, and so it's that thing, that sort of grieving process. But, I mean, I was amazed when I saw on the television a man in Moore, Oklahoma. It seemed like it was minutes after the tornado, say. He's there in a torn T-shirt, but he holds his fist up and he says, "We're going to rebuild." And there's that something that in human nature, I've read something that said the thought that things are bound to improve is stitched into our human consciousness. And I think that's really a cool thing. And Greensburg ended up not only rebuilding, but rebuilding totally green. They, you know, they built a lot of buildings according to LEED Platinum standards, and they're a little model city now.
That's that attachment to home. I mean, some people might say, "The heck with this place, I'm out of here." But there's also the response that you're talking about, like, "This is our home. We're going to stay and make it better."
Yes, and I mean, some people do decide to leave, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, then they decide they will find some place that maybe won't have another tornado, or won't. Older people sometimes decide, well, then I'm going to go and live closer to my kin. But there are all sorts of scenarios that. But that amazing spirit that seems to happen after disasters where people just rally around, it's just really heartwarming to see.
We're talking to journalist Sally Ohms about her new book, Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. We're going to hear some more stories from her coming up after the break.
And we're also taking your calls. How do you define home? Have you had to maybe change the definition in the face of the unexpected and maybe rebuild a home? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. 1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
We're continuing our conversation with journalist Sally Ohms about her new book, Finding Home, about people who've lost their homes. We're also taking your calls. What does home mean to you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org.
We'll get some more of the stories that Sally tells in her book in just a few moments. But first, we'll go to the phones. We've got Josie in Madison. Josie, hi, you're on the air. What does home mean to you? What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was raised by an Air Force officer, so we moved a lot by nature of that. I went to 13 schools before graduating high school. And then when I was, or 1997, so I must have been about 10, we lived in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and that's the year the flood hit, and we lost our home. We lost everything. And that really kind of shaped who my sisters and I, how we thought of home, because home was where our family was. We didn't have a house. We didn't have things to go back to. So I kind of developed a really transient idea of home. It was always where my things were. So then I went to university, and I did 4 semesters abroad, and I moved to London after graduating and was always very content with that. I was very happy. And I came back to Wisconsin to visit my parents who were living here and met a man who lived in the same house from the time he was 12 until he was 32 when he married me. And it was we have very different ideas of home. And we bought a house last year, and I had a full-on panic attack because I've never lived in one house for more than 5 years. And he obviously lived in the same house for 20. So we have some interesting conversations in our house about how long we're going to stay in one spot, what home means. We have a baby on the way, so what does that mean for our baby? So it's a really interesting, totally different dynamic from where my husband comes from as where I come from.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that story, Josie. Well, two different concepts of what a home is, yeah. Sally, in the same household there.
Mean, and I find that it evolves for people. I think probably for all of us, but that's really an extreme case. That's just amazing, the things that that she's had to deal with and think about, but absolutely.
And that also reminds me, you have a chapter, as you mentioned, about foster children who may never settle into a happy household. You had actually kind of inspiring stories about people who came out of that situation. Can you share that?
Yeah. In fact, I was thinking when your caller was talking, I was thinking of the former foster kids because that's the same sort of experience, although at least Josie, it sounded like, did have a family that she was traveling around with, the foster kids that I talked to, the former foster kids, are being helped by an organization in San Diego that some people put together called Fostering Opportunities, and they give them scholarships to go to college. But they go a little farther than that. Then they go ahead and they help them. I think people probably know that when foster kids age out at 18, then lots of times they're just out on the streets, and they are out on the streets without any life skills. So this organization is also helping them with that. But one of the most amazing stories to me was a woman in San Diego County who, when I went to visit her, was living in a one-bedroom house, and she had adopted her teenage sister, and who was not the easiest because she'd been through foster care systems too. And so anyway, she also had in the one bedroom her 98-year-old grandfather, who was on hospice, and he was due to die within a week or so, which he did pass away. She was holding down 3 jobs. She was going to school. She just had this amazing spirit, and it was that thing of that things are bound to get better that she just continued with. But I just read you just the last little passage of hers, and she says, "I've been trying to find or make a home lots of times, but I've found it has to happen inside me. The only thing I can do is control me. I'm a spiritual person. I rely on a higher power, but I find that home is within myself." And I think that's what happens, and I think that's what your caller is talking about. and what she and her husband are talking about.
We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Mark in Richland Center. Hi there, Mark.
Hello. When you speak about staying in one place for a long time, the continuity that develops within a city is really dependent on people to be able to have that consistency. In Richmond, California, the mayor there named Gail McLaughlin had seen a very strong town falling apart with the recent economic crisis, and all of these people in a blue-collar town where she's the mayor in Richmond, California, through no fault of their own, watching these houses be foreclosed on by banks that created the problem, but the people themselves are losing their homes. Mm-hmm. And she sees her whole town fall apart by way of this process called foreclosure, and she says, this is crazy. There's nothing these people actually did that they should be losing their homes. And so on a proactive basis, she exercises eminent domain, takes the house from the bank, says to the person living in the house, you're underwater on your house, but you didn't do something that's really wrong.
Well,
the bank created this problem. So then she finds alternative financing and keeps people in their houses through the vehicle of eminent domain. Now, if that had happened in Detroit, or if that's something that happens in towns all across this country, the falling apart of our neighborhoods where people are just, you know, you look at some of these families that the house has been in the family for years. This person has been in the city for all these years. They've been making their mortgage payments. It can tear apart an entire community. And there's virtually no reason why that should have to happen. And this lady takes it straight on and she says, I'm not afraid of Wall Street. I have the power. It's a legitimate power of government. And it's truly holding her town together.
Mark, thanks for the call. What do you think about that? I mean, whether that particular policy is interesting or something you'd approve of, what do you think the impact of foreclosures on that community sense of home that you were talking about earlier?
Well, that's really inspiring. I'm writing this down because for the sequel, that's definitely a place I would like to visit. And that's that whole feeling then again of that the mayor has of home as a community. She's not going to let that happen to her community. And I have a man in the book named Mike Lofton. He's director of a program in Santa Fe called HomeWise. And this is a not-for-profit, and he's helping people become homeowners. And a lot of them have been foreclosed on in the past. So he's saying owning a home is the great American dream, and also it can be the great security provider. But he thinks that this is the perfect time to buy a house. But he is bound and determined to have people go into it and give them education about it and what the financial situation is today. And he studies each one sort of on a case-by-case basis and for what their potential is, what they need, and what goes into this process. So he's working on that angle, and I think that's really commendable. He's giving classes on what it takes to buy and maintain a home because in this atmosphere, in these financial times, so they won't get themselves into into those dire straits and won't be hoodwinked. So,
just in our last minute, one more story you tell that's kind of universal. Every family will face it at some point or another.
Uh-huh.
A senior citizen making decision, stay at home, go into some kind of assisted care.
Yeah.
Do you see people successfully making that adjustment of a concept of home when they move out, when they move into some kind of facility?
Yeah, it really depends on the individual. And I started talking to a man in Iowa who owns 6 retirement homes, I believe. And he said that almost inevitably people make that decision too late. Lots of times they move in and they say, oh, I wish I'd done this before. but it is a huge adjustment. And I talked to a lot of people who in Iowa then who had come from a farming base. And I think farmers have a particularly rooted feeling about home, about that place, that specific place. And so it was hard for them to say. I mean, lots of times their children would just have to come to them, or their children would try and keep them in their own homes, which is so hard, and they're not equipped to do that really. So, yeah, it's an enormously hard decision, and I think a lot of us have tried to talk our parents into that kind of situation. I mean, there was one elderly woman in Iowa who was just determined to stay in the house that her father had built, and that was the way with lots of the farmers. They were third generation, and but anyway, her sister lived next door, and she'd raised her children in this place, but she just kept falling down, and her doctor said, well, I mean, are you going to kill yourself, or are you going to go to a retirement home? That's she really didn't want to. And he said,
Sally,
well,
we're going to have to leave it there. A conversation a lot of us are having. If you're out there listening, share your thoughts on what a home is on the Central Time Facebook page. That was Sally Ohms. Her book is Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we continue our Hidden Wisconsin series. Today we go behind the scenes with Beltline Bob, whose job it is to help motorists in distress along a busy stretch of highway.
But first, a public hearing is underway in Hurley. It's the first of two hearings required for the permitting process of a proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin.
Gogebic Taconite is asking the state's Department of Natural Resources for permission to move 4,000 tons of rock from the site of the proposed mine using excavation equipment or explosives.
The hearing began today at 10 o'clock at Hurley High School in Iron County and is expected to go until 8 o'clock this evening. WPR reporter Mike Simonson is covering the hearing and joins us now from Hurley High School. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good afternoon.
So what exactly is Gogebic Taconite asking permission to do?
It's two things. Bulk sampling is what we've been reporting on, but it's also comment on the notice of intent to mine, which they don't need approval for, but that's commenting on the larger mining issue. The bulk sampling is, as you said, removing rock. In this case, it would be 4,000 tons of rock in about four or five different places. It could be using explosives in doing that.
Could you explain why 4,000 tons?
No. I'll leave that one to the geologists. But that is the amount and what people are concerned about in the testimony today. And let me just give you some of the latest numbers that just came out of this hearing. The testimony stopped at about 2:30 this afternoon. They went through 73 people testifying, about 3-minute limits for each. And by my count, about half a dozen of those people were in favor of mining. All the rest were against mining. But people were also allowed to register for this. And 151 people registered for today's hearing. Out of that, still overwhelmingly against, but 38 people registered in favor of the mine. So those are the statistics. And a lot of the concern is when they're doing this bulk sampling, what will happen to the air emissions? What will be in the dust? What will happen to the water and the dust from falling into the water?
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about some of those who spoke in favor of the mine and or registered in favor. What are their main arguments for supporting it?
The argument for is the need for jobs. This is an economically depressed area, and you know that's been a big part of the argument for Iron County. You know, it is ironic because this is the heart of the support for the mine. GTAC headquarters are in Hurley. The Iron County board's been in favor of this and voted that way. The Iron County Democrats have. You go to Ashland County, it is not just mixed, but it is now leaning against the mine. And a lot of local government officials near the mine, like in Mellon, are pretty upset about this mine possibility. So there is a rift, but you know, on one side it's jobs, but on the other side, the anti-mining people point out too, jobs is important for them because if all these streams are cut off by a 4.5-mile, 1,000-foot deep mine, that's going to hurt a lot of recreational and tourism jobs.
This has been a very contentious issue. I'm wondering what the scene is like there? Has it been a very intense day?
It's been very cordial. I'm not surprised. Every time, this is the third hearing that I've covered, third or fourth, over the last 2 or 3 years, and people have been cordial. Maybe one of the most dramatic was a testimony by an anti-mining person. His name is Carl Sack, and he asked a question about the mine and if they're feeling pressure from the Walker administration. I have 3 minutes to speak, and I will stand here for the remainder of my 3 minutes while you ask, while you answer that. Well, they didn't answer that. So that was maybe about as tense, if maybe a little bit of humor mixed in with it.
Mm-hmm. One of the primary opponents of the mine has been the Bad River Tribe. Have they made any comments today?
There have been a lot of tribal members, mm-hmm. but except for Red Cliff Chairwoman Rose Gurno Sawyer, none of the tribal chair people have been here today, which is a little bit of a surprise because they've really been a force in the past. But a lot of tribal members have said, well, they're speaking for themselves, and they're here, and they, you know, make it clear they are here to protect the land. As far as they're concerned, there will be no mine.
Mm. Well, yeah, the Bad River Tribe, as a sovereign nation, they say that the mine has become a federal issue, not just a state issue. Where does that stand right now?
Well, that's just beginning, and that is an interesting thing. We knew that the shoe would drop at some point, and this week, Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins said that they are going to that. They think that the state process is, as he said it, a joke because of the new mining legislation passed this winter. And so they're just saying, the heck with this. We're not going to let them start to blow things up, even with bulk sampling, which is mini mining. He said, we're not going to let that happen, so we're going right to the feds because we think it's inevitable if it's up to the state.
Will that have any impact on how Gogebic Taconite proceeds, though? Will that actually hold things up a bit?
Yeah, well, the federal government can sure do that. Mm-hmm. The EPA has a lot of criteria, so does the Army Corps of Engineers, about use of and the environment, use of explosives. Even ATF would be involved in something like that. So there are really several federal agencies who, and because, as you mentioned, Bad River is a sovereign nation, and they have that right by treaty, that they have to be addressed. And the tribes don't think they've been adequately addressed by GTAC or the DNR, so they're, you know, going right to the feds now.
Mm. So what role does today's hearing play in the approval process for the mine?
It's a mandated public hearing, so it's part of the process. Still another 60 days or so before a decision is made on bulk sampling. I did talk to the DNR's Ann Coakley, who's been, you know, the lead spokeswoman on this case, and I said, is it a foregone conclusion that they will be given the okay to do this under certain circumstances? And she said, no, it is not, but we're still at least 60 days away from a decision by the DNR, but if it is approved, GTAC could start bulk sampling in October.
So talk about the sampling a little bit, if you can. What does it involve, and what's being tested for?
Well, it's four different spots. I'm not sure how deep it goes. They would use explosives, probably. And a lot of people are concerned, well, would that be, you know, affect the fault line? Because there is an old fault line there. They'd use ammonia nitrate if they did use explosives. As you mentioned earlier, they'd use heavy equipment. There's also a lot of sample rock left over from 1960 when U.S. Steel was considering making northern Wisconsin what is now Minnesota's Iron Range and mining there. So they can look at a lot of that leftover kind of scrap rock. So that's pretty much what it would involve, but they'd have to truck out about 4,000 tons of rock, and that's a lot of big machinery.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, but I'm wondering about what the testing means for the mining process. What kind of information will they gain from it, and how does it inform the process going forward?
Well, the DNR needs to look to see if there is grunerite. That's a mineral in the Pinocchio Range, as in the Minnesota's Iron Range and the UP of Wisconsin, grunerite sometimes, less than 50% of the time, has an asbestos-like fiber, which would be a health concern. But apparently there are like three different kinds of asbestos-like fibers, and one is fairly harmless, but another one is very lethal and can cause lung cancer, mesothelioma. There have been a lot of cases of that on the Iron Range of Minnesota. So, I mean, that's really kind of a million-dollar question, and perhaps bulk sampling could figure that out. But a lot of people here say, well, if you're going to be blowing that up and there really is that stuff in the air, we shouldn't even bulk sample.
So we mentioned earlier there are two public hearings. When is the next one?
The next one's probably not for quite a ways away. The new law eliminated contested case hearings, which is like a courtroom procedure, as well as other public hearings. So there are only two. The next one would be for the mining permit itself. And the company can't even apply for the mine permit for almost a year because they have to. It's a year after you submit the notice of intent to apply for the mine. So that's quite a. That's why this hearing is really important. It's a unique situation where people have a chance to, you know, say what they need to say. But there's only going to be two mandatory ones unless the DNR decides to call another one.
Mm. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you betcha.
That's Mike Simonson, WPR's reporter based in Superior.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then it's Hidden Wisconsin. Today we'll hear from a roadside guardian angel who goes by the name Beltline Bob. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. If you spend any time on major highways in Wisconsin, you know there can be a lot of delays. Construction, accidents, flat tires, the list goes on and on.
Well, in our Hidden Wisconsin segment today, we'll talk to a sheriff's deputy assigned to the Beltline Highway in the Madison area. His job centers on helping people in distress when traffic is heaviest. He joins us now to talk about his job.
Eric Novotny is a sheriff's deputy in the Dane County Sheriff's Office. He also goes by the nickname Beltline Bob. Eric, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
So how would you describe your job?
My job, best described as being someone who gets to a scene quickly and assesses it and sees if he can clear it as quickly and safely as possible, or if that cannot be done using the equipment and the truck that I have to protect it and advise as many motorists as I can that there is a problem with the roadway and give them instructions on how to get around whatever scene we have at the time.
On any given day, what's the most normal kind of call? What are you doing all the time?
I would say that the two biggest ones are going to be disabled vehicles and, unfortunately, crashes. The crashes are more centrally located around the rush hour times, and, in fact, everybody thinks of a morning rush hour and an evening rush hour. In fact, there is actually a afternoon rush hour, which sometimes we have more of our serious crashes. The disabled vehicles run the gamut of being disabled in the lane of traffic with somebody waiting for a tow truck or just disabled where somebody left it alongside the roadway.
Hmm. What are the biggest mistakes that you see drivers making?
Not calling 911. Not getting emergency vehicle behind whatever problem, an accident, or disabled on that roadway. That roadway, the Beltline, is 16 miles long, and unfortunately, people think it's the interstate. People drive it like the interstate, and it's not the interstate. The speed limits and the topography of that roadway with all the on-ramps and off-ramps can't handle speeds higher than 55 miles an hour, but unfortunately people do. So whatever incident occurs on that roadway, even if it's on the shoulder, it affects the flow of traffic by it. So when somebody has an accident or disabled, they figure that they could handle it themselves, call a friend or relative to come bring them out a tire or some gas, and they put themselves in danger.
What do you think they're thinking there? Like, oh, it's just a flat tire. It's not an emergency. I don't want to trouble the emergency response system.
That's the thinking. But there's some signs on the roadway that says shoulder only to be used for an emergency. And on that roadway, even if you're on the shoulder, you're in a dangerous location. And especially in the lane of traffic, you're in a dangerous location. So trying to get the word out to anybody who's listening to see if they they do have an issue or a disabled vehicle or something on that roadway, that they call 911. Lots of people are hesitant to call 911 because they don't want to bother us. They don't think it's an emergency. But what they're doing, in fact, is calling to prevent an emergency, because I can get there quickly, either move them to a safe location or protect them, and thus reducing secondary crashes.
Now, that's probably, I'm guessing that's true of any major highway. If you're on the shoulder, you ought to call for help right away?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No one is going to tell you you shouldn't be calling 911 on any major roadway in this state. Out in the country, two lanes, no traffic, maybe. But on any major roadway that's an interstate or county highway roadway, 911 could be should be called just to see if the car can stay there or if the police officer can help you in with dealing with whatever you have.
Well, Eric, Bob,
yes.
I was thinking about your job today, and I got a little bit worried. This sounds like a very dangerous job for you.
It's not for the faint of heart working out on that roadway. I've been one of the first people to start it back in December of 2001. The one thing that I can probably say that I do is you never can get complacent about that roadway. The roadway stays the same, but the people who drive it, you have to have eyes in the back of your head, and you always have to be aware of your surroundings and escape routes and stuff, because it does get a little hairy sometimes. If people would just drive 55 miles an hour, would not multitask while they're driving, leave enough space in between them and the front of the vehicle, between them and the vehicle in front of them, and merge courteously on and off the roadways, I probably wouldn't have a job. But that's not reality, because that roadway is people drive it like they're the most important person in the world, and whatever they're doing is more important than everything else. So yes, it does get dicey at times.
What are you equipped with?
My main piece of equipment is my truck.
Mm-hmm.
It's very noticeable. It's bright, high vis yellow. People think it's a strange color for a law enforcement vehicle, but it's all to be noticed. So I do not get, or my truck doesn't get hit. My truck is a GMC Duramax diesel. I have emergency lights and siren, and probably the two biggest pieces of equipment that I have is a signboard that can be raised and lowered, and it's a programmable message board that I can put messages on to advise vehicles behind me that there's something different about the roadway, give them instructions that they have to do something prior to getting to my vehicle to get around us, and give them instructions on how to proceed past us. Probably the biggest, the next piece of equipment is my push bumper. I have a extended, very large push bumper, and I've pushed, pulled, dragged most anything you could think of, semis, cars, to get them out of the lane of traffic so it can free up traffic back to its normal flow as soon as possible.
So, Beltline Bob, I got to know the personal side. You show up, somebody's off on the shoulder. They didn't call 911. They're not expecting somebody to show up at random and help them. What is their reaction like when you come up to help?
They first initially think that I'm either the tow truck operator or a county highway worker, because unless they've heard about me prior, usually with us have been working on this roadway for about almost 12 plus years, the commuters, the residents, generally know when I show up what I'm going to be doing and helping them and stuff. It's the visitors, the people who pass through, they are a little perplexed because lots of them say that they don't have this service in their state, and they're very appreciative of me showing up, because when I was working as a regular Dane County Sheriff's deputy in a normal squad car, people usually weren't too happy to see me, but now in my current capacity, they are very appreciative after they realize that they should have called me earlier, that I show up and I'm either helping them get off the roadway or protecting them till we can get a tow truck there to get them off the roadway safely.
Was that a nice change of pace for you, going from being unwelcome to welcome?
Yes, yes. We hand out comment cards because people are so appreciative that they want to do something for us, and we say we can't accept anything. So there's a comment card that we can hand out to them. And in fact, my partner got proposed to jokingly after helping a person on the roadway. So
did they say yes?
It's nice, yes.
They did not accept the proposal.
No, okay. he's currently married. Yes.
Gotcha.
Real quick, how did you get the nickname Beltline Bob? And we only have a few seconds left.
Okay. Because of our radio numbers, and there's a B in front of the radio number, mm-hmm. one of our dispatchers during a high-stressed call that needed to get a lot of information, she just got tongue-tied all of a sudden and just blurted out, Beltline Bob. And a local radio station was a traffic reporter was listening at the time, and once she heard that, it became history, and there's no way we could even think about changing our nickname. I don't mind it, even though people think my name is actually Bob. It's not, but I have no problems with it. It's catchy.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Eric Novotny, a.k.a. Beltline Bob, Sheriff's Deputy in the Dane County Sheriff's Office.
If you have an idea for a Hidden Wisconsin segment where we focus on little recognized but vital jobs, you can post it on the Central Time Facebook page or leave us a message on our hotline, 1-855-683-5422.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time Food Friday, we're going to talk about pickles. We'll hear how to make the best pickles and use up those cucumbers.
And we'll round up the news with Noah Ovshinsky. That's tomorrow on Central Time.